From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq, opening a second war front in the region. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq would stretch out for years, as you know, and they required cooperation with people on the ground from both countries. Over time, thousands of people from Afghanistan and Iraq would risk their lives to help the United States. Many would serve as interpreters, and as a consequence, some became targets of terrorist organizations. Some were assassinated simply for helping American units. That's why Presidents Bush and Obama recognized the need to help and protect them. Two different bills passed in 2007 and 2009 created so-called SIVs, special immigrant visas. You help the United States on the battlefield or in sensitive situations, and your family can find a path to freedom through this program. But really, the program simply expanded an existing program, offering special immigrant visas to those who provided faithful and valuable services in these contexts. And yet it still takes several years for SIVs to be vetted and approved, and now it appears the entire program could be ending. The U.S. Senate has approved a defense bill totaling more than $700 billion. It's called the National Defense Authorization Act. The Senate decided not to include any SIVs, meaning no more special immigrant visas for the interpreters who helped the United States. Republicans have repeatedly stressed the need for much stricter immigration policies on all levels, and we've heard both political commentators and President Trump himself discuss their concerns that non-white immigration is threatening culture and societies here and in Europe. No One Left Behind is an organization that advocates for SIVs, the interpreters who assisted us in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they say this defense bill is an injustice. Let's talk about it with our guests who are here this hour. Ellen Smith is the chapter president of No One Left Behind. Ellen, it's nice to see you again. Thank you for inviting us. And before I introduce the other guests, the history of the program, is that roughly accurate, what you heard there? I mean, is that kind of what we're looking at here, a possible end to this kind of a program with this
yes,
bill?
Yes, that's correct.
Fair enough. Okay. Our thanks to the other guests who are here with us in studio. Araz Majid is an SIV from Iraq who was an interpreter with the U.S. Army. Araz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Haji Yuldash. Yuldash has been an English teacher and was a cultural advisor for the United States and doing some work here in Rochester, going to be a teacher's aide in the Rochester School District for the next year. Nice to have you. Thank you for being
here. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Jawaid Samadi was an interpreter for the U.S. Army. And Dr. Samadi, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Ellen, you reached out to me just a few days ago. We have talked about this program in the past. I have seen you on my own time in the airport. I bumped into you. I think I was coming back from Spain on the WXXI trip, and who is there? Of course, Ellen Smith and No One Left Behind are there. You've done so much work over the years on this. What is exactly, in your mind, the possible outcome? If this bill is approved, I know it goes to the president's desk. Could this be a one-year sort of shift in it? Are you worried about a long-term consequence? What are we looking at here?
Well, right now, language was taken out of the National Defense Authorization Act for the SIVs. We believe it was removed in the House by Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, and it was removed, we think, in the Senate by Charles Grassley. And we don't know why, except that Grassley has said that he wanted to see more integrity in the program. And we're not sure exactly what that means when they talk about integrity. And what Bob Goodlatte said is that there must be reasonable limits on these programs. Well, what does that mean exactly by reasonable limits? We do not know. But what we know is that today the president is in New York signing the National Defense Authorization Act and the $700 billion that this entails, and there is not one visa for these interpreters and support personnel that our military needs and cannot do without in these countries.
They count on this kind of help.
They count on this help. That's correct. The interpreters and support personnel are there side by side, shoulder to shoulder, as we say. They're not only the translators, but people don't realize how much we contract out. They are the mechanics for the military vehicles. They are the logistics guys to get items from point A to point B without being blown up by the Taliban or ISIL. So these are the guys that our military relies on, and we made them a promise, and we are now breaking that promise, and it means death for these families.
I want to stress the point that Ellen is making here. That's not necessarily hyperbole. People can become targets.
It's the UN estimates that one interpreter or support personnel is killed every 36 hours.
Every 36 hours. How many people are we talking about annually has this program served in the last decade, Ellen?
It's a false number on what we've served and what we and who we need to serve and the numbers we need. Right now, for instance, there's 9,985 Afghan applicants who have worked for the military, who have put in their application under the Special Immigrant Visa Program, but we've typically only allotted between 3,500 and 4,000 visas a year. So we never have as many visas as are needed.
Do you have hope that today, given the fact that the president is set to sign this bill today, is there any last-minute hope to change
this? No, there's no last-minute hope on the National Defense Authorization Act. There's no hope whatsoever.
He's going to sign it.
He's going to sign it, and there are no provisions for these families in that bill.
I've got a long PDF document on a lawsuit that goes back a couple of months now trying to change some of the game here. What's going on with the lawsuit?
So the lawsuit was brought by the International Refugee Assistance Program called IRAP, and it used to be known as the Iraqi Refugee Assistance Program. But under the law that Congress has mandated for this program, visas are to be approved within 9 months because it is literally a life and death situation. Once these men or the women are found out, they are hunted, they are tortured, they are killed. So it is imperative that we get them to the United States, to the safety of our shores, as quickly as possible. Congress said, that's 9 months. You have 9 months, State Department, to get them over here. And the fact is, it takes a minimum of 2 years. Most of the people I work with, it's taken them 4, 6, even 10 years to get over here.
So in a moment, we're going to hear their stories. But the notion that we need to sort of tighten up or clean up the program seems kind of ludicrous to you.
These guys have been through thorough vetting. You need to be thoroughly vetted to work for the military in these war zones. They are thoroughly vetted. They're thoroughly vetted every 6 months. And then they're thoroughly vetted to get over here. You can't get any more thoroughly vetted than what these men and their families have to go through right now.
Can I ask you, Ellen, what you think this really is about? And I ask because, especially in the last week, we've seen the president, when he was in Europe, warning about immigration changing culture for the worse. And we saw 5 days ago, Laura Ingraham from Fox News making comments about the changing demographics of our country and how she thinks that let's listen. This is the 30-second clip from Laura Ingraham's Fox News show. And if you're confused about this, I don't mean to hyperbolize. This is the language of white nationalism. I've spoken to white nationalists myself who say, hey, it's great to hear Laura Ingraham actually use our words. This is what she said on the show last week.
In some parts of the country, it does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted upon the American people. And they're changes that none of us ever voted for and most of us don't like. From Virginia to California, we see stark examples of how radically, in some ways, the country has changed. Now, much of this is related to both illegal and, in some cases, legal immigration that, of course, progressives love.
In some cases, legal. She's not trying to hide it. This isn't a case where she's saying, oh, I was just talking about illegal immigration. No, she's saying immigration of all stripes. And that is, if you read white nationalism, if you talk to white nationalists as I have, that's very simple white nationalism. Is that part of this? Do you think that that's starting to permeate what our lawmakers are doing in Washington?
The only thing I can think of is that these lawmakers and these people have not met the men and their families who I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And if they met them, they would know that these men are the America that I know and love. These men fought for our values, and they fought side by side with our soldiers, and these are the new Americans that, I want to see in my country. And I just think that that the problem is we have not been building bridges enough, perhaps, with these communities and reaching out. And do I think that's where this comes from? I don't want to say yes, because I don't want to believe that. But on the other hand, I have no other reason except to say that there's this racial prejudice going on where they do not want to see any more Muslims coming into the country because they don't know and they don't understand.
Well, I think it's valuable to hear the stories of the people who have served our armed forces, served our country, served the nation. Araz Majeed, let me just kind of go back a little bit and ask you where you grew up, and then we'll talk about some of your service.
Sure. So my name is Araz Majeed, and I'm from Iraq. I grew up in Tikrit, Saladin. And I started work with the U.S. Army as an interpreter since 2008. Till I get my visa in 2013.
2008, you started?
Yes.
What was childhood, what was it like for you? What do you remember studying growing up, some of your interests as well?
Well, I'm graduated from University of Baghdad, engineering and computer. And when I first started my job, we all was applying for the job, not really for the money what we get monthly. It's just about the freedom and help. Because an interpreter in our country is not just a language between English and Arabic. We was a culture advisor. We were helping a lot of the trooper about understand our culture and understand all the city in our country.
In 2008, when you became an interpreter for the U.S. Army, did you hesitate at all? Were you worried about what that meant for your safety?
Exactly.
Yeah?
When I first started 3 years, then it's hard to explain to my family I was an interpreter with the U.S. Army. Our contract was 26 days staying in the base and take 4 days off. And those 4 days, you can't go outside the base because we lost a lot of interpreters in the days off when they go home.
They were targeted?
Yes.
So 26 days of work, 4 days off, but you quickly learned that you couldn't leave anyway.
Yes, no, you can't leave. And some of the interpreters, they work really in a bad area. They really staying for like 6 or more months in the base because they can't leave the base.
So is that where you did most of your work, in
yes,
the base?
Yes.
What was an average work day like for you?
Our job when I first started, I was working with the Kirov team that we go on a mission outside the base. And in that time, we really can't show our face to the people outside. So we try to wear a mask to hide our face because we know we are the target. But they are target us. They waiting for us outside the base to catch us outside and kill a lot of interpreter.
When you were, I guess, several months into the work, did you think this was going to be a job that would go on months, years? How long did you end up doing the job?
Well, first of all, when I see it, we lose an interpreter every single day. Mm-hmm. I decided to leave the job. But something to push me more to do my job because it's helped more than just an interpreter. So we know that we all join for one reason, that we need to help through when we need that. And we promise that we get our bag hauled that what we did in our country.
What do you want for Iraq in the future?
For my country or for all the interpreter?
Well, for the country. What are your hopes for Iraq?
We all hope our country will be better than before. We are all not happy what's going on in my country. It's really hard to visit. I still have one sister she left behind. She has 3 kids. I did bring all my parents here, my brother and sister, but I still have one sister. And it's hard for us to go back because we still target. It's really hard for all interpreters to go back to their country because the terrorists, they know those people they was helping U.S. government back there.
Tell me about the process that you had to go through before you were able to come to the United States.
So the process for the SIV, they ask you to apply to get a recommendation from the POC, that point of contact, who interpreter who work 1 year or more to be qualified to work and to apply for that program. So when I did first apply, they asked me for a lot of paperwork, and I did the first interview, and then asked you to do the medical exam. But after 8 months, and that will be April 2013, I get an email from U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, ask me to two choices: to get my visa and leave the country without my son and my wife, or stay for them to get the visa and we can live together. And I was still working as an interpreter with OSCI, the Office of Security Cooperation Iraq, and they have a direct contract with the Department of Defense. So I have no choice to stay. So I read emails that I really need that visa and leave. So I take the visa and I left the country, and I left my wife and my son behind.
Hmm. What has been the outcome for them?
For
your wife and son?
Well, after I arrived to the United States in July, I keep sending emails to the U.S. Embassy, but it's still the same email sent back to me every single time I send an email. Till they get a visa, they take them like 4 months to get approved for the visa and arrive here.
Where are they now?
Yes.
They're
in the United States. Yep.
They're in the United States? Okay. How are they doing?
Doing good.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
what is life like for you here now, Aras?
It's really hard because when we come here, we start from the zero. And when I say we start from the zero, that we really left everything behind us, that everything like that, the degree we earn, the family, the friend. But we start to build our life from the zero, and we do very good. I mean, there's a lot of friend of mine. They do a good work. As of me, I'm a business owner of the used car dealership. So I see a lot of SIV people. They are doing very good.
You're doing car dealership work?
Yes.
I might need a new car. So where's your dealership?
In Syracuse.
In Syracuse?
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad to hear you're doing well.
Thank you.
And I'm remarkably grateful for the work that you did for American Forces. What were the relationships that you built? What was life like when you worked with the forces?
We are like one family, because the 26 days staying in the base, it's like we like a brother. I see a lot of friends in the military more than I see my family. You know what I mean? So if you stay like 5 months straight in the base, and you see like every single day the same faces that you work with, sleep with, eat with, you know, that's like we are like more than family. And I had a lot of friend at the early U.S. Army. He's like my brother from another mother. That's what we say. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love
so
that.
So it's like the really close friend to me.
And now I wonder, do you feel like things have changed in this country at all? How do you feel about where things are here?
It's every country had something different that people there in the country, they don't really like what the government do. But in the same time, it's not really in our hand to do something. So we try to change, we try to do the best, but we really can't do. But we hope everything will be good in this country, or like my country, or in Afghanistan, or any country in the world.
Do you feel support from the friends that you've made in this country?
Back home?
No, I mean, whether you're
yes.
Syracuse, Rochester, yeah. Western New York.
Yes. Yeah? Yes. There's a lot of people understand our situation, and the people understand our situation who work with us back home. So like they know what an interpreter did in back in Iraq or Afghanistan. So like they understand it's worth for us to be here. It's a promise. We don't need anything. We just need the promise that they get who left behind in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is all what we need.
What do you envision for your future? What do you want your future to be, Aras?
Well, I have two kids, and I don't think I can take my kids back home, because I want my kids, they are grow up here. One of my kids is born here, and one is in Iraq. I want my kids, they work hard as how I work hard to raise them. So sometimes, like, when we talk with our family back home, they ask me, do you have any chance to go back in Iraq? And I say, like, no. Because I don't want to, like, my kids go through what I did mm-hmm. back in Iraq.
Does this feel like home to you now?
Here?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
How old are your kids?
6 years and 3 years.
I got a six-year-old boy. It's a crazy time, isn't it?
Yes.
That's great. Well, I'm very, very hopeful that that future is exactly what you envision. And I think your family being here makes this country better.
Thank you.
And I'm really glad you're here.
Thanks.
That's Araz Majid, who is an SIV. When you hear, by the way, listeners, when you hear SIV, Special Immigrant Visa, just one more time, Ellen, you want to explain what that term means, because we're going to hear it throughout the hour.
The Special Immigrant Visa Program is the program that the interpreters and support personnel who worked for the U.S. military in Afghanistan and Iraq, that's the program that brings them here to the United States. Special immigrant visas are not given out to anyone else. You had to be in Afghanistan or Iraq and work for the military or a contractor.
Well, let me get one phone call before we hear. We've got more stories to share with you as we talk about this. But Tom in Batavia is calling. He served in Iraq and wants to weigh in on what he's hearing. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, thanks, Evan, for taking my phone call.
Sure.
And the first story that we just heard was something that I experienced with helping out the interpreters that I had on my staff when I was in Iraq working for the Army Corps of Engineers. These were technical interpreters. They were three women I had on my staff that would review technical documents that were in Iraqi and bank records, stuff that we needed to do to help do our mission to rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure. And as early as I think your guest had said was when I started to, you know, ponder the idea of helping these folks was, boy, wouldn't these be the people I would like to have stay in Iraq and help build their government and their infrastructure up there, people that answer their call to serve. But then in the meantime, I know what risks they took every day going in and out of the green zone and how some days they couldn't show up for work because someone was threatening them if they left their house. So, yeah, you know, I do what I do to help the people that are next to you, the people that take the same risk in a combat zone, whether they're out with combat forces or engineers rebuilding water plants. And, yeah, I got them going and I got their initial packages in. I left Iraq in 2008 and their paperwork had barely gotten through the first stage of the process. But at least for two out of those three women that I helped, their visas did get approved. They got to the United States. They're U.S. citizens now. And I forwarded on to Megan a couple of pictures of a ceremony I went when one of their sons, the son of one of the ladies I helped out, became a U.S. Army soldier when he graduated basic training back almost 4.5 years ago when I was still in the Navy. And that's probably one of the proudest moments of my life was helping those folks do that.
Well, thank you, Tom. And producer Megan Mack saying she's going to go ahead and throw them up on Twitter if your listeners want to see some of the pictures that Tom sent here. But, Tom, before I let you go, I just got an email from a listener named Herman who's asking, well, what can we do right now? The president's going to sign this defense bill. What do you want to see happen for the folks like the SIVs in this room, Tom?
You know, hopefully our commander-in-chief there recognizes the fact that that service to your country doesn't necessarily mean, you know, being a combat soldier. It's being an interpreter. They've risked it as just as much as I did over there, as much as the other troopers that I stay with. These folks need to get their visas approved. They need to come here. I mean, that's, you know, what credibility do we have, you know, when we ask for this type of help in the future and whatever other operation, fill in the blank freedom you have, where we won't have the full trust of the people that we're asking to help us because we know that, you know, they may not be able to get access to what we have in the future. That just doesn't put our troops in a good spot. I want to see these guys get, I want to see these people in, make a special executive order if our commander in chief likes to do that kind of stuff, saying that these folks have a waiver to get in now, and then if there's other concerns, well, let's work them through that. But, you know, they risked it just as much as we did. They deserve it.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. And again, we'll share some of the pictures he's talking about. And so let me turn back to Ellen Smith as we reset the hour here. We're talking about special immigrant visas for interpreters and in Iraq and Afghanistan that have been funded and permitted by the thousands, not perhaps as quickly as some would want or at the level some would want, but certainly they've been there for 10 years now. And the current bill that could be signed today by the president, the National Defense Authorization Act, is $717 billion, and it doesn't fund these visas anymore. Could be the end of this kind of a program. I don't know, Ellen, what this could do to our relationships in different places where we need help from people who... What is the signal? Could this jeopardize
our relationships? Well, the signal is put yourself in their shoes. I mean, I'm sorry. If I'm going to risk my life for someone under the promise that if I'm threatened with getting my head cut off, with being disemboweled and watching myself die, if I'm threatened with the fact that my wife might be turned into a sex slave, as well as my daughters, and my six-year-old son will be taught to shoot people in the head if he is captured by ISIL, and he will essentially be ISIL's death slave. That's what these people risk if they are caught. And we have turned our backs on them. And why in the hell should we get any help for any future war or any time we need to go into combat if we turn our backs on these people? Why?
Tell our listeners where they can learn more about the organization.
They can learn more at www.nooneleft.org. That's our national website, and our local Facebook page is No One Left Behind, Rochester, New York chapter.
Herman in Brighton says, since the legislation is about to become law, what actions can we still take? Is there any point in contacting senators? What else can be done?
There is absolutely a point in contacting your senators and members of Congress. Unfortunately, we have no one to contact right now. Chris Collins is, of course, out of the race for now, and we don't have Louise Slaughter anymore, who was incredibly supportive to our program. So we're feeling a little lost here in this district in New York. You can contact, please, Kirsten Chilibrand and Charles Schumer. We'd like to get an emergency piece of legislation. We had this in 2014, the Afghan Allies Act, and apparently right now, late Friday, there was a bill introduced by Democrats called the Afghan and Iraqi Allies Resettlement Improvement Act. Now, I do not have the details on that bill. I don't know where it would go because it was introduced by Democrats and there's such partisan division. But I have to tell you that on this issue, what we have always seen is the Republicans and the Democrats come together on this issue, because we all agree that these people should not be left behind. There are a few people who have taken these provisions out of this defense bill, and shame on them. But we can rectify it. But when Congress comes back in September, we're only going to have about 2 weeks to do so. So it's very, very important that everyone gets on the same page on this.
And Bush and Obama agreed on this, didn't they?
Bush and Obama, all the former secretaries of defense, all the former State Department, heads of the State Department. This is something everyone agrees on. Everyone.
Or did. Yeah. Let me turn to Haji Yildash, who was a cultural advisor for the U.S. Army. Why don't we work through your story? So childhood was where for you? Where did you grow up?
First of all, thanks for giving us some time to share our views. My name is Yildash. I am from Afghanistan. I grew up in northern Afghanistan. So after graduating my bachelor degree in India, I started working with the U.S. Army and NATO forces in Afghanistan. The childhood was pretty unusual because our country is third world country, so it's totally different from here, and a lot of bad things are going on there. And we hope, our hope is that our country also get better. The situation is over more worse and worse, and that's why we come here, especially I come here, with the hope to the land of opportunity that USA, America is called in the world, the land of opportunity. And I come here with a hope And because we risked our life over there, many guys have been died and many guys have been killed. So they deserve to live in a peaceful country like USA.
What was the danger like? I mean, you heard Araz tell his story about one interpreter dying almost on a daily basis. As a cultural advisor, what did you see? What were your fears when you were serving?
Oh, yeah. Many of my friends also have been killed in the, by IEDs and by attacks. Even I witnessed two of my friends who has been killed in the outside the zoo, wire in dangerous places. So one of them were recently engaged, and the other one had a small child, and there was no persons on his family to look up his children. So there are many guys, that kind of persons that I am giving an example. They deserve to visas to come here.
Tell me about what your service as a cultural advisor required on a day-to-day basis.
We used to attend officers' meeting between U.S. Army and the Afghan National Army. We used to translate from English to Dari, and we used to translate paper-based documents like classified informations. And we used to give them cultural and social courtesy and information to each side. And we were meddling or being mediator between two different people, between West and East. So we used to be called as a secret weapon. We played very significant role in the history during 10, 15 years. But these our sacrifice and our services should not be neglected by two or three persons. I think we all are, I don't say that we are Muslims. We all are humans. There's no differences. We all have one sky, one sun, and we all have one goal, that is to serve each other or to help each other. That is the contagion. Kindness is a contagious.
How many languages do you speak?
Six.
Six languages?
Yes.
What are the languages?
I speak Persian, Urdu, Hindi, Turkish, English, and Uzbeki, Turkmeni, and some small other language like Pashtus.
You can see why he described himself as a possible secret weapon for the, because it's not just the language too, it's also the social custom, understanding of different interactions. What has life been like for you here? How long have you been here?
It's been just more than 3 months, about 4 months.
And how's it going for you?
It's great. Rochester is a beautiful city, and I love it. Everything is getting better. And I come here with a great hope. And my goal is getting established with the help of no one left behind. There are such a very good people around here. They are helping me too.
And what is your vision or hope for your future? Where do you want to be? What would you like to do?
My family is behind. I left them over there because of some financial problems. I have two children. My goal is to bring them as soon as possible here, because I don't sense they are in a safe situations, because situation is over there is getting worse and worse day by day. My goal, that to bring them as soon as possible here.
Yeah. And how old are your children?
8 and 10.
Oh, wow. And where exactly are they living?
In the northern provinces.
Okay. Yeah. You know, Ellen, my six-year-old in school this year, there was an Afghan child in class. And, you know, when kids are 5, 6 years old, they don't really understand why the world has conflict the way it does. So my son said to me someday, he said, you know, someday we should go to Wasik's country, you know, and maybe we can spend some time there. And I thought, boy, wouldn't that be wonderful to have a world where we could make a trip to Afghanistan and to feel comfortable. That's the world we're trying to build. Kids, I don't think, understand it.
It's the world that I certainly envision, because I have to tell you, when I see photographs from our guys of Afghanistan and just such beautiful areas of that country, it has such great potential. It is so beautiful, and I certainly would love to see, you know, peace there and relations again, where they can have visitors and they can live in peace.
Let me take another phone call. Bonnie wants to tell us some of her thoughts about what she's been hearing this hour. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear people who are, you know, presenting the way your guests are. It's, you know, just how could you in any way want to put them in harm's way? It's just unbelievable. So one of the things I would say, and this may sound harsh to some people, but I think language is important. We need to, all of us, including me, needs to give language to this situation as what it is. It's an act of cruelty and an act of racism. And there's no other, you know, polite, nice way to say it. And I think when you say it and frame it that way, it's a strong message to people in general to help, you know, clarify what these things really are, what they look like. And also, not that our president really cares about much of anything, and I don't think it makes any difference to him. Just people are just his objects. So it might not reach that level, but it really does mean something to name things the way they are. And maybe your guests are not wanting to use that language because they want to be polite, but it really is an act of cruelty, utmost cruelty, and racism. So,
Bonnie, I have to say,
Bonnie, thank you.
Yeah, and I just want to say that the words I was using last week were betrayal. That this was just a complete and utter betrayal by our president and this Congress on what they've done. It's a betrayal to our troops, because they need to rely on the interpreters, the troops that are there now, and it's a betrayal to these families.
And again, if you're just joining us, in an average month, I think, Ellen, you were saying, for example, Catholic Family Center would have upwards of 100 arrivals?
Yeah, on an average month, I was looking at the numbers, and they averaged 90 arrivals last year, 90 a month. And for the month of August, they're having 8 total. And we, at No One Left Behind, we would average a family about every 2 weeks, sometimes once a week. And we've not had anyone in since Haji came. We did get an Iraqi family in 3 weeks ago, but we had Haji in April, and we've gone down to hardly any arrivals whatsoever. So most of my work right now is advocating and working with the guys who are still over there to work with the soldiers that they worked with on getting them here. But with this program closed down, I can't even get them here.
And before we hear Dr. Samadi's story, I want to ask you, Ellen, because our listeners might be wondering, when families come over, and again, often it might start with someone like Yuldash comes, hoping eventually his children and his family will be able to come. What kind of resources do you need to help them, whether it's basic resources, whether it's job help? What are the kind of things that you can tell us about that?
No One Left Behind provides their first month's rent and security, their first food. They are entitled to 180 days of food stamps and DSS assistance, but then it gets cut off. So they need first month's rent, security, food. They need a place to live. We need co-signers for apartments. They need furniture. Right now, we're kind of overloaded with furniture donations because we have not had any arrivals. I do expect that we should have some arrivals before October 1st, just based on the people telling me in Afghanistan they've gotten their medicals. And, you know, these guys just, they need work. And the other thing we do is we provide a very, very modest vehicle. We do take vehicle donations. And if we have to buy a car, it's no more than $3,000 if we buy a car for them, so they can get to work in these really hard Rochester winters.
The defense budget is $717 billion, and it does appear that these authorized visas and funding for them could be zero. So let's get back to the story so you can understand exactly who we have been trying to make sure. I was going to say serve seems the wrong word when they've been serving us, but Dr. Javed Samadi was an interpreter for the U.S. Army. And Dr. Samadi, why don't you grab that mic, get really close to it. There you go. And tell us your story, where you grew up and how you ended up as an interpreter.
I grew up in Kabul, and I finished my bachelor's degree in Kabul University.
Just get really close so we can hear you.
And then I joined the U.S. military, the Special Forces. I worked with them for 3 years. Then I moved on to another academy, which was for the officers of the Afghan Army. And I worked there for 1 year. So that was a total of 4 years service that I did.
Starting when?
It was 2002 until 2006.
Okay. What do you remember about the day-to-day work? What did that entail? What did you need to do on a day-to-day basis?
When I first joined my work, it was supporting the Afghan army. We were building the army. I was interpreting for the special forces who were directly training the newly recruited soldiers. They would teach them how to be organized in their barracks, how to shoot a gun, how to respect their officers. So everything from A to Z was taught by the, because there was no army. Army was gone. So it was building from the battalion to battalion. So when I joined them, it was the 5th battalion. And there are now maybe hundreds of them.
Wow. You were in the 5th battalion.
Yeah, it was
early
the
5th, days.
Very early days.
Very early days.
And I also did some translation work. I also traveled with the special forces to some of the provinces where they were needed by land. I spent days as a medic too in some of the provinces too. We were treating village patients with the help of the American medics. Yeah, so I did these things when I was working with them.
What kind of medical work did you do?
We were treating patients, from the village just to establish goodwill with people. Mm-hmm. So people would come, and then we had a tent, and we called it a medic tent. So people would come, and we would give them medicine, something not advanced, but something like primary medications.
Sure. Okay. Tell me a little bit about the safety or the security of the work that you were doing. Did you fear for your safety?
Initially, there was it was okay. There was no fear because the Taliban government had collapsed and there was no insurgency. So we felt okay. But later on, this insurgency grew up and there was growing risks. Until that, when we were going back and forth from job, we were feeling that anytime there may be a suicide attack or maybe a direct attack to us as a translator, as an interpreter, because people started to know us that we were working with the U.S. Army. And especially people in my village, in the village that I grew up, there were many people with the insurgency. And those people started to call me on their phones, some of those insurgents, and threatened me that I was a target for them because I worked with the Americans. Infidels.
Infidels?
Yes.
What did you say?
Well, I couldn't say anything. I just, as soon as I received the call, I would put them in a block list and then they would call me from another number. But then we couldn't do anything about the threats other than just to keep ourselves as safe as possible.
What was the process like in coming to the United States?
Yeah, it was very time-taking. Just like my friend from Iraq, Azhar.
Araz
said, I applied in September 2008. I received the U.S. General's letter of support for my application. That time it was required. And my case was in Islamabad. My case was approved in 2009, but then it was sent to Islamabad embassy because no embassy. We had no consulate in Kabul. So I traveled to Islamabad embassy with my family. I did medical requirements. And then I was put on wait. I came back to Kabul. After 2 years, I was asked if I needed to transfer my case to Kabul, and I said, yes, they can do it. Then I had another medical examinations. They were all very expensive. And then I was waiting for one more year, and they told me that my medical examinations expired, so I had to do them for the third time. So eventually I did the last medical examinations for me and my family in 2013, and then I received my visa and for my family, for me and two of my kids, wife and two of my kids.
Two of your kids?
Yeah, my wife and two of my kids.
Okay. How many kids do you have?
Two. I have three now because I have a boy now.
Okay.
I have two daughters in Kabul, and I have a boy who is born in the U.S.
And how is everyone doing?
Yeah, they're doing great. Everyone is good here.
And what is life like for you here?
Yeah, it's a very busy and very good life for me, for my family. Financially, we're well off, better off. And I am in the process of buying a home. And I'm happy. My family is even happier than me.
They're even happier than you.
It wasn't always easy for Juwayd, though. Juwayd was the second SIV that I helped in Rochester. And, you know, when I met him, I mean, he was as poor as any other poor American here in Rochester. And it was really hard to help him. I mean, here I had a guy with more education than I had, and I was supposed to be advising him on jobs, and I couldn't. So Juwayd has done really, really well. And we're very proud of him.
I'm glad to hear
that.
Thank you. And can I ask you also, you know, we listened to that sound clip from earlier this hour of a Fox News host just saying that she thinks both illegal and legal immigration have foisted change that most Americans don't want, even though surveys do not agree with that contention. But when you hear that, when you hear the anxiety that people have about multiculturalism, what in your experience, how do you want to respond to that fear?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, about that clip, it's totally disappointing. I know many people will not have that idea, but it is not acceptable. We shouldn't hear them even from very few people, especially from politicians, because they are representatives that people have voted for, and not all voters are, for that. They're many voters who have voted for these politicians are against these things. So it's not good for them to say such things. And I really want a country. America is a global symbol of multiculturalism, a symbol of diversity. And I want this country to stay like that. In my country, in Afghanistan, we have this issue of sectarian politics, issue of hate, which has been still going on. And part of the reason of the war is this problem of tribes and hate. And I have traveled here with my family. I don't want to see these things here, and I really want something better.
I think he makes such an important point that I would point to a couple of different places. You could look at Afghanistan, the tribalism and the pain that has come from that. But this notion, the fearing multiculturalism, that multiculturalism inevitably leads to that, and that the way to safety that we heard, whether it was Charlottesville or Laura Ingraham or elsewhere, is to sort of homogenize populations. One of the most homogenous populations in the world is Ireland, which has seen some of the most remarkable strife over the years. You talk about homogenous. You don't simply avoid strife, by homogenizing populations. And in fact, multiculturalism and the celebration of diversity, the arms linked, the American U.S. forces working with Araz and Yuldash and Juwaid and all of the wonderful people who have said, we were not born in the same place. We do not speak first the same languages. We don't have the same color of skin or religion, but we are all together, is a demonstration of where I hope we're going.
Yeah, exactly.
I certainly hope so. And Juwaid, I hope your future is just as bright as your family wants to see it. And
thank you.
So congratulations on the success that you've had, and thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Yuldash. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for not only serving the U.S. Armed Forces, but for making this country better in so many ways, for making this region better, this town better. And Ellen, I'm really glad you reached out. Today is a big day with the signing of this bill, but I guess I'm going to turn it over to you for the last 30 seconds or so. And why don't you tell me what you think the best case scenario is going forward? Because, again, as you say, the president's probably going to sign this bill. So what happens next?
The bottom line is we need a permanent solution to this problem. We're dealing with it right now year to year. And when war ends, you know, then there's your limit. Then we don't need this program anymore. But as long as we are in war and we have troops needing support, we need something like the Afghan and Iraqi Allies Resettlement Improvement Act or Protection Act, whatever you want to call it. But there needs to be some mechanism, permanent mechanism, in place, because what's going on now doesn't work.
Learn more online. No One Left Behind is a national organization, and Ellen is the chapter president for the local chapter. Online where?
www.nooneleft.org.
nooneleft.org. Thank you. Thank you for the work that
you're
doing here.
Thank you.
And I know it's more difficult these days, but thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.